Hello and welcome back to the Shifting Lens podcast, where we're reviewing the animal experience. Today, myself and Tiamat are joined again by Melvin Chan. This is the part two for the episode that we just released. So feel free to go back and watch that one first, because it'll give you an idea of where we're starting from today. So we were just talking about how important it is when we're considering social and emotional learning to ensure that that's a multi-species view of the concept and not human specific. So to pick up from where we left off, I'm going to ask Melvin to maybe talk a little bit about what these programs look like practically with the inclusion of animals and how they could still exist without live animals being included and have similar benefits.
Yeah, thanks again for having me on for a second time on this podcast, Rebecca and Tiamat. Yeah, always a pleasure, and it's fun to continue off our conversation. And so thinking about what these programs look like, just to recap, so they could be, you know, it could be one lesson, it could be many lessons. Some programs, you know, not they don't have animals, but they can have over 100 lessons. So it could be long or it could be short. Generally, we find that longer programs and more intensive programs, so, you know, 30 minutes versus 5 minutes or 3 minutes, whatever, is better. And so we tend to err on that side. So within, you know, these programs that include animals for the promotion of social emotional competencies or for social and emotional learning, you might have, let's say, a 30 minute lesson once a week for 6 weeks, 8 weeks, you know, and you have the dog that comes in, you know, for some set amount of time. It could be the whole 30 minutes. It could be a shorter amount of time. And, you know, you have these participants, these kids or these youth or both doing something with the dog. And it's, you know, related to whatever the lesson is, you know, for that day. If it's perspective taking, you know, maybe, you know, in the classroom, you're all sitting in a circle and you're sort of, you know, talking to each other, learning about, you know, what other people's perspectives are, but also thinking about, well, what is the dog thinking? What behavior is the dog, you know, sharing with us? Or what are they trying to communicate with us? What might that tell us about what's going on in their noggin? You might be doing, you know, other activities as well that help you develop perspective taking, or if it's meant for empathy or meant for self-regulation or whatever, you could be doing something about that. And so a lot of the time, with these particular programs that include animals, again, in my review, in my research, there were 28 that sort of met the criteria for inclusion in my review. Yeah, they found positive, most of them, 21 or 70, 75%, something like that, found the positive outcomes. And so for the children and the youth. The problem is that, yeah, we don't know how the animals are benefiting or what outcomes there are for animals, even if they're neutral, which I think for people would be acceptable as long as it's not, you know, we're harming them in some way. So even if it doesn't affect them, or if they do like it and it benefits them, then that's good. That hasn't really been looked at in the study, in a lot of these studies. And so I think we can turn to the field, again, of social and emotional learning within the discipline of educational, you know, research to see that, well, there are a lot of programs that are effective for promoting empathy, for promoting pro-social behavior or what have you, that don't include animals. And it's demonstrated, there are meta-analyses, there's a lot of empirical research that really show this. I think the solution, or a solution, it's a bit of an avoiding one of just, you know, not even having the animals there at all, but extending, right, like what we think empathy is and to whom empathy applies. And so if we are saying, well, empathy is not only towards other people, but also towards other animals, and we're including that in our definition of what it means, we are also measuring that in the assessments that we use, then I would hypothesize, or I would suppose, that we should also see benefits, and we should also see the outcomes we're kind of interested in or wanting out of these programs. And so that kind of like whole, it just sidesteps the whole issue of what's going on with these animals, period, when they're involved in these programs. But again, I do think that there's a place if people, if, you know, there's an animal who really wants to be involved, I don't think we should bar them and say, well, no, you can't because we're not measuring these things about you. So, you know, we're not going to include you. I think that we still can, but I think we need to do more things and to actually measure and to actually think about their participation rather than just viewing them as tools, for example.
Yeah, I'm not sure if you know of Dr. Michelle Witham-Jones's research with AI with donkeys. I think she's working with a donkey sanctuary in Exeter and got her PhD in anthropology. So what I really enjoyed about her work is that she kind of went into it looking at, okay, I'm going to look at how donkeys are working with children with autism or on the spectrum. And what really came out for her, at least what she would always kind of talk about at conferences and sort of what she was sharing her work was, that there are just days where a donkey, or even moments, like you mentioned in part one, where the donkeys in the will not feel like it. They might want to work in the morning, and by the afternoon they're tired, or vice versa. In the morning they're not having a good day. By the afternoon they've had some hay and they're feeling great. And the kids as well. They might have a day where they're really wanting to engage with other animals, other people, even, and other days where they don't really feel like it, just like everyone does, right? But in different ways. And I think sort of that, or my question for you, actually, let me phrase it that way, is whether that acknowledgement is really then part of the lesson, right? If we say, well, the donkey is really not feeling like it today, like, why might that be, like, on that note of empathy, or even, you know, egomorph, how can we relate to this donkey as being more like us as just individual, like individual to individual versus like human-like, right? So what your thoughts are on that, essentially, like, I mean, you kind of mentioned it now a bit, but sort of bringing in that example and sort of the contrast, I guess, of, well, it might not always work as planned, but we can adjust it to fit that everyone's happy.
Yeah, that's a really excellent point. I love that example. I'm not familiar with her work, although I think I might have heard of her work, because I mean, who doesn't, when someone does donkey stuff, you generally get it through the grapevine. Yeah, I absolutely think that that's part of it, and learning that they also can implement boundaries and that they also can have, they have choices that they are making all the time. It's not just that humans are the ones, are the only ones who can make choices, right? And also thinking about what choice means and what it means to want to participate in some activity. So absolutely, it's absolutely part of it. And I would, I would include that. I would say that it's included, let's say, implicitly right now in a lot of the, in some of the studies that have been done, that it isn't an explicit focus saying that, like, well, does the animal want that? And you're really posing that question, you know, to the kids. It seems to be more of a, well, we should, you know, at the top, look at, you know, do these animals want to be there? But not actually translating that out to the people who are actually, you know, implementing these programs, or to the kids who are actually being involved in these programs either. So yeah, like, I think there's opportunity for us to really bring that in into the curriculum more, and adapt more to what these animals are feeling like, what the kids are feeling like, even how the teachers or the staff, how they're feeling that day, and how, you know, they're implementing these lessons. There's a lot of work done in implementation science. There's a very, very thorough review published in 2008 by Durlach and Dupree. So anyway, this is it's referenced like all the time, just because it is such a good paper that summarizes all these factors that affect the implementation of programs. But yeah, so I mean, going back to it, like, things like teacher efficacy and your mood, your training, all these things are part of it. And when you have a program, we can't always expect that you're going to do exactly, you know, what all of the words say when you're given your lesson plan or when you're given the program. There are going to be differences, and there are going to be changes made, not only because of, you know, how confident people are in delivering it, or how they're feeling, or what time they have even during their day to deliver the lesson, but also because of the context, right? Like, maybe it's developed for a particular population And maybe the kids you're serving are not of that population. And so you need to change a few things. Or maybe you don't have the full 1 hour, but you have 45 minutes, that is, or 30 minutes. That is still a change that you're making. These adaptations, so to speak, for your context. And so I think that including animals as part of that will be a step in the right direction so that we can actually value them for being who they are. And for wanting to participate or not wanting to participate. The other kind of, or another side to this as well, is actually some research done by John Tyler Binfett, who actually was one of my supervisors. But he had looked at dosage, so to speak, so how much of the intervention you're getting. And he looks at animals as a therapy, specifically with dogs and university students. But he looked at, instead of having a set schedule, what if we let the people choose how long they want to be there for? And so they're self-administering in a way. And you know that, yeah, there's actually some people need 15 minutes, some need 30 minutes, and see, that reduces their stress. I think on the flip side, we should also do that for the animals. We should let them choose how long they want to be there. But I think this is an indication that like it's possible that we can be more flexible with the interventions that we've created and are creating and then are implementing. And sort of in parallel to this, in the field of social and emotional learning, so there's work done by Stephanie Jones at Harvard University, but she has sort of coined and kind of developed this idea of social and emotional learning kernels, which are like practices that you could do, because not everyone has time in their day for a 30-minute lesson when you're a busy teacher and you have like you have many 30-minute lessons for science and math and reading, whatever you have to do. So then social emotional learning is yet another thing you have to, you know, tack on. And there's, you know, work to like integrate it with subjects and whatever. But she's kind of really pioneered this idea of 15-minute practices, 10-minute long practices, whatever, that you can just do whenever you want, every day. And then that can help, you know, develop your, or they start looking at whether that can help develop your social emotional competencies. So I think that kind of idea can be applied in this field as well, looking when we're looking at animals, and to help really create a space where everyone, you know, can choose when they want, what they want. And you can also, I think you can tailor it better. There's all these, you know, other things too.
Yeah, I like that idea. It kind of made me curious, though, what different species were present in your studies that you looked at and how you think that maybe impacted the efficacy and the ways it was measured, but also how you think that the different species may have been impacted by this, by being included in the program.
Yeah. That's a great question, because there were a lot of species that were represented across all 28 studies. So the most common, and some studies used more or had more than one, included more than one species of animal. But the most common species included were dogs, horses, and wild birds. And it involved some kind of interaction with these animals. In the case of the birds, it was like observation, you know, of these birds. And so other species, you know, kind of also spanned this like traditional companion, you know, animal, and then you have your farmed animal and you have wildlife. So animals like cats, rabbits, guinea pigs, really big with guinea pigs. Well, there are a lot of people who like guinea pigs, and, you know, cows, goats, sheep, snakes, spiders, elephants. What was another? Oh, horseshoe crabs. So there's a whole range, yeah, of species that were incorporated. And they are from, I mean, multiple other disciplines too. When you're doing, right, like this kind of review, you're not limiting it to any particular, you know, they didn't limit it to the anthrozoological space. It was anything that I could call anthrozoology or human animal interaction was included. So there's stuff from like science education, from environmental education, like all these different, you know, sub-disciplines as well. And so, yeah, I think that's partially why we have all these different animal species. Monkeys actually was another species because some of these programs took place in zoos. And so I think that the impacts or the outcomes of these programs for these different animals would for sure differ based on their species. Again, it wasn't measured. It wasn't really looked at as an endpoint in any of these studies. And so it's hard to say that like these animals weren't harmed through the process of participating in these studies. And so I think then when it comes to, yeah, looking at how we're including them and like what they're actually doing, let me know if, you know, you want me to re-answer part of your question. I think that needs to be conceptualized more, not even reconceptualized, because I don't think people are even looking at like what are benefits to horseshoe crabs other than, you know, their increased conservation or, you know, there's more of them out there. Because for this, which is great for, you know, populations, like if we're speaking at the population level, but for this particular animal, right, like are they getting anything? And, you know, what does that look like? I don't even know. I mean, people have looked at what pain looks like, I assume, in arthropods, but I'm like, well, I have no idea. Like what is a positive outcome for a horseshoe crab? And so I think these are things that like we need to turn to other fields as well, like, you know, animal welfare science or whatever, to integrate in to really like ensure that we're treating them in the way that they deserve to be treated.
Really fascinating. I could talk about this for ages, but I guess like for myself as a scholar looking at the intersection of like animal labor and then also interspecies emotional labor specifically, that's naturally going to come up for me with a topic like this because it is requiring such immense and extensive emotional labor from the animals. And I guess before I ask my question, I want to have sort of the question of if you sort of are familiar with that emotion management studies when it comes to other animals or sort of interspecies emotion management, or if that came into your discussion at all before asking a more specific question about it.
Yeah, I am not. It is amusing that came up for me much later on in the thesis process. So I started my thesis, not this past summer, but last summer, so 2020. And it was throughout, I still had some courses left. I had a lot of courses in my degree that I had to take. And so through some of those courses, I was really thinking more and more about animal labor and about just what the heck we were doing in these kinds of programs. And so there was one paper I referenced about emotional labor in my discussion. I think it was published in 2020 or something like that. But I referenced it specifically because it mentioned that, and it was amusing that I just kind of plopped in there. So really besides that, I don't know anything about it. And this is like such a wonderful area that I think needs more credit for the, you know, for just how useful and applicable it is. So love to learn and to
talk about it. I think it's just, there's such a need for there to be an emphasis on their education for that. So really preparing the animals for this. So you don't just have an animal who, like you said, the happy dog or probably most likely a Labrador in a lot of cases who just loves being around kids and everyone's like, great, let's just put them together with the children. And I know that there is of course some people who educate animals for AAI, but sort of specifically that emphasis on, are they taught to really align their emotion displays, right? Like their exterior, their external, observable, acoustic, everything, emotion displays in a way that really aligns with how they're really feeling. And I'm sort of going to just sort of describe it really quickly if that's okay with everyone, just because to give it some context, because then I can ask you questions about it. So there's like different strategies that they can use to perform emotional labor. And so like the two main ones, like surface and deep acting. So I'm not going to make a lecture out of this, but just like really sort of a crash course, description of that would be sort of surface acting, pretty much how it sounds, like below the surface, you're not feeling how you are externally. So your internal feelings aren't in alignment with your expressions and your demeanor, right? And that's actually shown to have really, really, really detrimental impact on workers, right? And then you have deep acting where you sort of either through redirection or through empathy, like you said, you can adjust how you're feeling so that what you're presenting is in alignment with that. And that can be like active, but it can also be passive. So passive would be like if the Labrador is just super excited and everything, but there's still work involved in that. And I think in a lot of these cases, what people are really talking about is the extensive surface acting that a lot of animals are needing to perform. So either because they've just burned out, they're experiencing emotional exhaustion. I don't know how many sessions they're asked to do daily, but that would of course be a factor. In addition to just them as an individual, but also their breeding, their breed, what animal they are, which children they're working with that day, like all of this comes into it. Like you said in part one, like working with emotions of any kind, there's just like asterisks everywhere and caveats and stuff, because it just, you can never really stop talking about it. But essentially, I'm curious what your thoughts are on that, when you can think of it through sort of emotion management lens and you think, okay, we have these different strategies. What sort of comes out just sort of initially for you when you hear about these strategies and you hear about emotional labor in terms of the well-being of the animals, but also sort of how they might be prepared for it or what might need to be considered for something like that? I know it's a big question, so just whatever kind of comes up for you.
Yeah, I think it's amusing that I need to continue on, and I hope that I can continue on that and really bring it more out of I wouldn't say like the depths, but like, you know, people don't think about animal labor as the first thing, right? Like, and I think people should be thinking about that as the first thing, because not only for the well-being of these animals, but because we think about teacher and staff labor as the first thing when we're thinking about these programs. And so what comes to mind for me, at least about, you know, the preparation and the training, like definitely, like the hand, like hands down, like if we're including an animal in these programs, they should be trained for it the same way that teachers or that staff or whomever else, the humans, are trained for it. And I think it comes back to really this, like extending the definitions and of constructs that we've created and things that we've looked at. So within implementation science, the self-efficacy piece, the training, the ongoing support, organization. So there's another big one, like organizational factors, things like, particularly in school settings, you know, do you have principal support? Do you have like support worker support, or like whoever else, you know, is around? Like if your principal thinks that this program is total crap, then you're not going to be able to implement it how well, right? Or however well you want to do it. And so the same kind of stuff applies to animals, that like, what about their handlers? And if they have handlers, which I also find is a problematic term, to have that, but you know, that is the term that's used. So I will stick to that for now. What about, the teachers or the other staff, right, who are there? What about, again, the principals, like do they, or, you know, the leaders of these institutions where you're implementing these programs, are they supportive? Like all of these things I think also apply. And if then we are also including specifically, therapy animals, then that should also be something that is, if we believe that that is a part of rigor or whatever, then it should be included and there should be certification or there should be something. Do I think that we necessarily like need to only include therapy animals? No. There has to be some kind of, I think, preparation, so that they aren't negatively harmed by only doing a bunch of surface acting. Which, I mean, I think even outside of the context of these programs, a lot of animals perform. And so like in shelter settings or at home, for example, like with our own pets, if we don't know how to like, you know, support them with that. And so I think it calls into question two things. The first is the relationship with emotional labor in humans, because there's a lot of work on that we haven't, you know, that I think we can make a lot of connections to. And then secondly, the social and emotional development and the competencies of these animals, and what that looks like in different species of animals as well. And of course, then for dogs or for cats or horses, probably other animals too, but I'm thinking about the breeds, right? Like of these animals. And does that look different? And, you know, if we're using like a term like self-management, let's say, or you're wanting to be, or calmness, whatever, like, what does that look like, you know, for a dog? Maybe it's easier to define than what it looks like for a crab, or for a spider, or for a snake. And so I think, yeah, like it really brings in, you know, like not just the human side of it, but that we are all animals, essentially, and that we all kind of share a lot of these similarities in terms of how we function. So I think it's really highlighting that a little bit more too.
Yeah. I mean, the thing with emotion management also is there's different terminology then if you're talking about sort of the personal sphere and the public domain. So if an animal is sort of performing formal work, which they would be then in these sessions, it would be emotional labor, whereas at home it would be more like emotional work, although there's a lot of overlap there and it's another one of those asterisks all over the place kind of things. But like you said, like pulling in literature from the extensive research on emotional labor with humans and in human-human interactions. And unfortunately, there is a focus also there. We were talking in part one about bringing in neurodivergence. There's a really unfortunate emphasis there also on able-bodied human-human interactions also in emotional labor literature. But other than sort of the classics like first responders, of course, and service workers, the next huge group that they're looking at for emotional labor and research is our teachers. So you think of the animals, the other animals who are there in those teaching settings in classrooms, whether they're in the zoo and the students are coming to them or whatever the case might be, but still in that teaching environment. I think that it's such a huge issue that in every field is overlooked because emotional labor is involved in anything that involves exchanges with work, right? And I think if people aren't looking at it for the interest of the other animals at heart, at the very least, well, this wouldn't be my ideal motivation to research this, but at the very least, you would think it would be of interest because it also has the children's health and safety in the mix, right? Like if you have a dog who's not performing emotional labor properly and their mask cracks, as they say, or there's a lapse in an emotional labor episode and they're not performing it correctly, or they haven't been taught, or they're burnt out and they're whatever, then it's, of course, then we can make it a human concern and look at it that way, if that gets people to pay attention. But either way, you know, no one's winning if we don't look at it. But I just thought that was really a sort of maybe something that would come up in future research in the area. And it's been really fascinating hearing your thoughts about it as well, learning more about that.
And thanks for asking. Like, I really think that is, like, it's so important that we are recognizing them as beings. And, you know, going back to the whole teacher point, right? Like I wouldn't, or even a therapist, but in this case, let's say teacher. I don't think that we should label them as co either, like co-therapist, co-teacher. Like I think they're a teacher in their own right. And that with regards to like the power dynamic, right, between that, like it's not that like the humans are always above these animals and then controlling and directing, that the animals also exert influence and they also have their choices on how they're doing it and how they're teaching and what they're teaching. And so I think it's really this kind of shift to not like to view them more as equal, but in a slightly different way than, you know, we're not saying that they're humans. We're saying a dog is still a dog, but we're saying that they have choices, they can think, and they can, you know, if they need to go pee, they should go pee and not be made to, you know, hold it in because only at 10:15 do you get a potty break or something. I mean, just same for people. Like if you have to go pee really bad, like you should go to the washroom, right? Like, so I think it's about extending up these kinds of thinkings to animals. And ensuring that we're speaking across different disciplines and not, you know, kind of doing things, I think, in isolation. So I think really what I hope is that given that everything is interdisciplinary about what we're talking about, that we can actually be a little bit more interdisciplinary. And even, you know, when it comes to safety and health risks and whatever, yeah, it is kind of like annoying. I agree with you that, like, I think that we shouldn't be doing it just because, you know, then the children are going to get bit because this dog, you know, doesn't behave itself or whatever. That only has only really, I think, been discussed in, like, or at least the paper was I'm thinking of is published in 2020. I think it's Dalton et al. 2020. And like James Chappelle also is, you know, is written about this with his colleagues too. And so yeah, it's a nice motivation, but I think it's still, I would call that at the surface, right? And there's still kind of deeper things that we should be looking at, which I think would like supersede all these, you know, biting incidents or transmission of disease. And I mean, that's also another concern and whatever. But I think if we're thinking about what it actually means to involve an animal, I think a lot of this would just kind of flow out of that.
That's great. Thanks. I really liked what you said about referring to them as like co-teachers and how maybe there's a whole overarching reframe required for how animals are actors within these programs. But yeah, I kind of wanted to ask. So we talked a lot about the gaps, the issues, the things that were maybe missing or should be considered with this kind of programming. And I know you're starting your PhD soon. So are you looking to stay with this kind of research area? And if so, what are your goals?
Yeah, definitely. There are a lot of issues. I will also acknowledge there are a lot of like, you know, positive things too. So it's not all in the band, but I feel like, you know, as a researcher, sometimes it's nice to be like, wow, here are a lot of ways. There are, you know, like at least for these studies I included. I mean, yeah, there are some nice things about the populations and like the kind of work, right? So I definitely think that, yeah, it's worthwhile. And definitely this is a field that I hope to continue in, or at least with the topic I hope to continue in for my PhD. I don't know exactly what I'll be doing in my dissertation yet, but it'll be, I assume, something along the lines of, you know, looking at how can we learn with other animals and not just how are we learning from or about or extracting things from other animals, but how can we exist in a world, right? Like together and create a world where not only people are thriving and flourishing, but that animals are also thriving and flourishing. So it'll be something along the lines of that. I like just started like this PhD, you know, a few days ago. So the first big hurdle is comprehensive exams. So yeah, I think it'll be something, you know, my exams will focus something like that. And kind of the other piece too is with programs, it is essentially like scientific management as applied to education. So like, I think it's Ralph Taylor, who was a big guy who like initially, you know, kind of thought about this. And it's a whole, like, there's a whole thing in like curriculum studies with like different kinds of programs and all these things. But another now really popular, but I think a more powerful kind of area is critical pedagogy. So the work of like Paulo Freire and I mean, it, not fully the same, but it's more learner-centered, they term it. But Vygotsky and, you know, kind of thinking, essentially looking at relationships. It's kind of really what it comes down to. And when you come to critical pedagogy, it's based on critical theory. So it's all about power. And there are things like, you know, anti-racist education, feminist education, like all that kind of stuff. And so I think the part with animals really belongs there. And it's really kind of viewing them as being marginalized, as being oppressed, because they are, and asking, well, how can we, you know, highlight that, and how can we change this about the way that we are working with animals and learning with animals? Kind of drawing in also, of course, some Donna Haraway's, you know, writings about the whole becoming with and that. So that's, I think, where I hope to go, and ideally in the future, even tackling cultural issues, which I'm sure both of you are much more familiar, you know, with than me, just from like an anthropological perspective, let's say. But yeah, like, you know, things like how different cultural groups view animals, and potentially, you know, getting into things like critical food studies, or, you know, even animal cruelty. I mean, that's a whole other problematic thing that also shows up actually in these programs and whenever we're, you know, then relating to animals, that like, what does it mean to be cruel? And how are we defining laws? How are we enforcing them? So maybe in 20 years, you know, I will get there, or 50 years, I will get there. Yeah, this is a great, I think, starting point for now.
We'll have to have you on in like a year or two to
see what happens.
Your research, and then maybe have like a flashback to this one and then edit in, like, kind of see how it's changed. That's always really interesting.
Yeah, we can all react to the things we talked about. Like, be like, wow, I was so cringe when I said this. I actually mean, yeah.
Do like a YouTube react video.
Yes.
Okay, well, thank you so much. That was fantastic. Thank you for joining us, Melvin, and having such a great discussion with us. This was really wonderful, and I look forward to hearing more in the future about where your research takes you. Thanks also to everyone who tuned in to watch or listen. We'll go ahead and put some links in the description for you from Melvin's work, as well as some of the research we talked about today, so you can kind of take a look at that after the fact. And thanks to Tiamat, too, my co-host, for being around and having that great emotional labor perspective to add, because I think having that plus the social and emotional competency background that Melvin has, this was a really great discussion. So yeah, thanks for joining us on The Shifting Lens.
Thank you so much for having me. And like, yeah, we'll have to chat again soon.
Definitely. It was amazing. Thank you.
Okay.
Bye.
Thanks. Bye.